Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, lovely listeners. Welcome back to an episode of Private Parts on your Friday. Alex and Jamie here.
That's right. Get ready to have your minds blown.
By who? By me? By
to
me.
Have your mind
no, by me. By me. Do you know why I would like to be in your body for a day?
Why? So you could walk up the stairs without it hurting?
No. What? Why? Because my butt hurts.
Does it? No. I meant more like your old knees, not your weird bum hole.
I thought you were talking about my rectum.
You just let out a secret. When you walk up the stairs, your butthole hurts.
No, it doesn't. What are you talking about?
Jamie Lang in his creaky butthole.
My butt doesn't hurt. What are you talking about?
You'd be terrible in a Western. You'd just be able to hear your...
I'd be great in a Western because I'd
look funny. No, because you'd give away your position. You'd have the John Wayne walk, but you're... Your creaky butthole would give away your position on
the spot. I told you the time that I went to the doctor's when my butt hurt and the doctor lubed up their finger and put it up my butt and went, yep, you got piles. And I went, what the fuck is that?
Yeah, you showed me your piles in Ibiza. You pulled your pants down and like reared, like reversed back into me. It was fucking horrible. Like a little vineyard.
We're playing a game of it with my piles. You're it. Catch them.
Oh. There's been some quite disgusting away trips.
There's been no disgusting away trips.
You've done a lot of weird things. Anyway, sorry. We digress. We have a very interesting podcast coming up.
We've got a great podcast today. We've got Merlin Sheldrake on.
Talking about all things mushrooms.
We have Merlin Sheldrake on the podcast. He is the author of A Tangled Life, a world-renowned bestseller. He is a biologist. He basically explains how fungi make our worlds, change our minds, and shape our futures.
Is that your own excerpt, did you read that straight from?
Listen, it says here he was University of Cambridge. He was always obsessed with it as well, which I find so interesting. He was always obsessed with it. And what is great about Merlin is that he explains something which is quite complicated to most people in a kind of a relatable way. Fungi is one of the most amazing things on this planet, and we underestimate its value, its power, its reach, its depth, everything. It's within us, it's among us, it does everything, and it's incredible what it does.
Have you taken mushrooms today?
I haven't taken any mushrooms, no.
You're sounding a little bit mushy.
I have not taken any... mushy? What?
Yeah. Like you're getting mushy. You're getting mushy about mushrooms.
Oh my God. Listen, before we say anything else, let's kick off the podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, here we go. Welcome to your Friday episode with Merlin Sheldrake on the podcast. Enjoy. Merlin, by the way, I think we tried to organize this podcast before, but something happened. And since the moment that I realized you were coming on the podcast, I've been over the moon excited, and to the point where we've got Alex. You brought your book.
I've got the hardback.
He's actually got the hardback version.
My grandma bought it for me because she realised how much I was into mushrooms, And I think she knew of your father. I can't actually remember what your dad did, but he was also quite a famous scientist, right?
Yeah, he's a biologist.
He's a biologist. Yeah. And then she discovered you and your work and gave me the book for, this was about a year ago. And I'm only halfway through it, which I hate to admit, but it's been fascinating. And actually, as guests go, I'm actually the most excited.
Yeah, he's the most excited ever.
To come on.
Can I tell you, so how does your grandmother know that you're into mushrooms?
Because I've spoken about it, not just like psilocybin, like the whole sort of culture of mushrooms.
Okay.
I feel like when people talk about mushrooms at the minute, everyone immediately goes, oh, they're talking about psychedelics and psilocybin. But from what I've read in the book, that's kind of a small bit of it almost. And there's this huge mushroom world that you're kind of uncovering and telling the world about. It's so fascinating.
Well, before we start speaking over, because we have so many questions, perhaps you can explain to our listeners who don't know who you are, what you do, what you're about, everything.
Everything.
Is that so? Yeah. And we got ages, don't worry. We got a whole day. So you give us everything.
So I'm a biologist and I study fungi, and fungi are a kingdom of life. And that means that there's a broad and busier category as animals or plants. So there's lots of ways to be a fungus. And we know very little about the fungal world. So there's a lot to think about. And there's a lot of open questions, and there's a lot of excitement when we talk and think and inquire about fungi. But one of the important things to mention probably early on is that when we think of fungi, we normally think of mushrooms. But mushrooms are just the reproductive structures of fungi, the place where they produce spores. But the most fungi live most of their lives as branching, fusing networks of tubular cells, which are called mycelium. And so fungal networks in the form of mycelium are a really important idea, and one I think that we'll keep coming back to today.
So, okay, hold on, so let's explain this more. So, firstly, how did you find yourself being interested in fungi and everything? Because that's, I suppose, out of all areas, you know, I suppose these things start when you're younger, right? When you become, and typically when we're younger, we're interested in trains or becoming policemen or, I don't know, becoming a stuntman. You're interested in fungi. Where does that come from?
Well, I also quite like trains.
Yeah, I don't know, I'm just not counting out everything else. Yeah, you only like fungi.
when I was little. Well, my father's a biologist, so he would encourage me and my brother to take an interest in the living world. And so I remember one of the things that got me interested in fungi, at least asking questions about the sub-visible realms of all the organisms that we can't see, but which are responsible for so much. I was like taking out buckets of compost to the compost heap in the garden, and then later, a few months later, helping shovel the new soil that had been made from the decomposition of this kitchen waste onto the flower beds, and being puzzled by this transformation. How does one thing change into something else? This thought, whenever I stop to think about it, still fills me with wonder today, even though I spent a lot more time thinking about it today than I had done when I was a child. And it was explained to me that fungi are some of these organisms that are responsible for this kind of transformation. And they have astonishing powers of transformation. They are, we might say, metabolically ingenious. And indeed, we live and breathe in the space that their decomposition lives behind. So this was one of the kinds of lines of puzzlement that led me into thinking about fungi. And another was symbiosis. I studied, as I got older and my biological studies progressed, I studied the relationships between plants and their fungal partners. And it became clear that I'd always thought of plants as just, like, there's one there, a plant in a pot. You know, just one organism sitting by itself, maybe around some other ones. It's all autonomous individuals. But this turned out not to be the case. And plants are bustling ecosystems, as indeed we are, filled with smaller organisms without which their lives and behaviors would be impossible. And so I became very interested in the ways that fungi form relationships and enter into relationships with other organisms, and indeed have formed relationships that have shaped the entire history of life and the whole, the way that the biosphere has evolved over hundreds of millions of years. So this opened up all sorts of other questions and curiosities for me.
Yeah, I mean, this is opening up so many for me. So how intelligent is fungi? It's like the intelligence of fungi, we have no idea, as you said at the beginning, about how smart they all are and how it entwines between everything in our life. You know, I feel completely separate to that plant, to that mushroom, to whatever it is, but actually we're all connected in some interesting way. And how does that even... My brain can't get itself around that.
It's tricky, isn't it? I mean, we're told so much by the legal and financial and societal and political systems in we live, that we are individuals responsible for our own actions.
This is what I mean, right?
We need that. I mean, to some degree, it'd be useful. You know, it's useful to have a concept of an individual when you're trying to fill out a tax return or get a passport.
Yeah.
And there are some things that this concept, it does work for us. But when that narrative becomes the main narrative that we're told about the way that we relate to the world around us, then we start to see ourselves as separate and disconnected, not just from organisms like plants, but from other humans and other members of our family and even parts of ourselves. So that disconnection could lead us into all sorts of trouble. And I think it's actually responsible for many of the big troubles that we face today as cultures and societies and nations, as a global community. So, I think it's a bamboozling thought and a fun confusion. I think it's a healthy confusion to have.
It is a healthy confusion to have, but also it's hard to, I suppose, to articulate to the sort of every individual, right? We're all humans, we're all sort of going about our everyday lives, and you're trying to articulate how important fungi is and how entwined it is in our lives. How do you articulate to the average individual who goes, well, I don't really care, I just want to, you know, focus on my own self, and actually get people interested and understand how important everything is?
Well, I think there are lots of ways to do it. Ultimately, it's storytelling.
Yeah.
As I think so much of our lives are, whatever we do. And this is what Entangled Life, the book, has been. It's a big exercise in trying to work out how can I talk about subject, which I have been a sort of nerdy pursuer of for much of my life, to people who might not want to read a book about science or the living world, let alone fungi, an unglamorous, gross, and disease-causing agent.
I know. That's the thing, right? Like we're told it's sort of, you know, when we're children, we reject any sort of fungi. We don't want anything to do with it. It is a sort of disgusting kind of thing. And what I find so fascinating, I know, Alex, you find this more fascinating, is how, you know, I saw this thing the other day, and you can sort of explain it to me, that that perhaps, you know, when we were, you know, talk about evolution, right? And, you know, the fact that we were primates back in the day, and supposedly, you were saying this the other day, that supposedly what happened was, is the way we gained intelligence was by eating fungi. And that's how we developed. Is that true?
The stoned ape Terence McKenna theory.
Is this true? And you can explain this better than I explained it.
So it's a hypothesis, a speculation advanced by Terence McKenna, who is a wonderful thinker and philosopher and ethnobotanist and a user of psychedelics. And he suggested that perhaps it was that humans acquired their large brains and intelligences and cultures and religions and philosophies and languages through the consumption of psychedelic mushrooms, which expanded the possibilities of our sensing and knowing. And so there are lots of different versions of the stoned ape hypothesis. And it's beyond dispute that psychedelics have shaped human cultures for an unknowably long time. In almost all parts of the world, traditional societies use plants or fungi that alter their minds, send them into different states of connection and perception. And these are enfolded within spiritual doctrines and venerated in all sorts of ways, are deeply embedded in human history. So that seems beyond doubt. The question is, how much influence did they play in the very earliest days of humans becoming humans? And one of the things that Terence suggested was that the eating of mushrooms helped our brains grow large. And it's hard to know either way. You know, my sense is that there must have been lots of factors at play, and it's possible that psychedelics were one of those. And there's certainly something to explain. We have very large brains relative to our primate cousins. And between 3 million years ago and about 200,000 years ago, when recognizable humans are thought to have emerged, more or less, our brains grew to four times the size than they had grown in the previous 60 million years of evolution. And so this is in the fossil record. No one denies this. It's called the brain boom.
So it's like a rapid leap, a huge leap.
Yeah, and so the question is why? So
why? That can't be down to taking.
Since Jamie found out about this theory, he's been cramming mushrooms, and he has to get a little bit more intelligent.
but I just can't fathom the fact that there's this giant leap, and surely it can't be down to the fact that.
So many people would agree with you and say that Terence was mistaken. There certainly seem to be other factors at play. For example, cooking, domestication of fire, being able to cook food meant that we could spend a lot less time finding food, because every bit of food that you eat would be more digestible. And it could power our brains, which are incredibly energy-hungry organs. Now, your brain makes up 2% of your body mass, but it requires 20% of your energy at rest. So to power these enormous organs, we would have had to had all sorts of new ways of accessing nutrition. So it seems that the fire thing is has a big role to play. But there are other things too, like being bipedal, having hands that are free to use tools and to gain dexterity, having vocal cords that allow certain types of sound making, which underpin language. So I think all of these things have to be in play. And it's possible that it seems most likely to me that psychedelics would have come in and turbocharged our cognitive evolution,
right,
without necessarily causing our brains to increase. But of course, these things don't work in isolation. It's not we have culture and then nature separated by some unbreachable divide. Now, you can imagine a situation where an early human took psychedelics and had the idea of domesticating fire and then start cooking and then outswells the brain. But I mean, that's a very trivial way of putting it, but as an illustration of the way that these things are all bound up together. But certainly I think it's important to recognize the role of psychedelics in our deep past.
As like a timeline, where has the brain size stopped growing, or is it continuing to... Because I wonder whether it's like an exponential thing, like sort of that little early spark, then kind of it just started to spiral, and that's why it expanded so quickly, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know what the latest stats are. I certainly feel like the more I sit in front of a computer and have a smartphone, that my brain would be maybe shrinking in size, because I'm outsourcing so much activity to machines. But I'm not sure of the latest.
But okay, but as a biologist, and as a, you know, a person who is engulfed their whole life in science, then what are your thoughts around, this is a deep one, I promise you, I haven't taken any shrooms when I'm saying this, but what are your thoughts then around death and religion and all those different things? How do you view that? What is your point of view on all those things?
Well, that's a very big question.
I know, that is a huge question. I don't know why.
Yeah. It's a very big question. And you've got 5 minutes. So.
but it's hard, right? Because I suppose, you know, it's quite hard to, when you have answers, it's quite hard to quantify anything else. Does that make sense?
Well, I mean, I'd say I have more questions than answers
in
general. And then the more answers I try to answer, the more questions I end up with, saddled with. And I think these questions about, you know, the divine and death and life, these big questions about the nature of reality, really, and the nature of our consciousness, that these questions, many of them are unanswerable, which is what pulls people into these questions, which is why they're still questions, you know, millions of or hundreds of thousands of years. I'm sure people have been asking these, wondering about these questions for as long as people have been people. And I don't suspect that we're going to have neat answers for them anytime soon, which means that it's the mystery. It's the way that we come close to the mystery and the mysteries, these things which are hidden from our view, which are confusing, fascinating, and which draw us towards them.
But
I think it's the mysteries.
But it's also like, but then we're, as humans, we're in this constant search and this constant desire to understand and realize and gain knowledge. And actually, perhaps there is something blissful about being innocent, right? And I've mentioned this before, but, you know, Blake wrote 2 poems about innocence and experience and how experience breaks innocence. And actually what happens with knowledge is that we become almost too experienced. And that also is a problem. And actually naivety is a blissful thing to be. Peter Pan said it actually perfectly well. The reason why he didn't want to grow old is because he became experienced and he didn't want to, follow the life of Captain Hook and things like this, these tyrants. Mm. So why do we have a desire to learn and to gain knowledge and to push boundaries when actually the sort of naivety, innocent space is almost more attractive as we get older?
It's a very good question, isn't it? And there are so many situations where, and cultures and traditions and wisdom traditions in which we're encouraged to find our innocence again. And that's...
Yes, exactly.
I mean, so this idea of beginner's mind, becoming, being playful, and that's how we learn, to be playful and to explore new things and to let ourselves be a child again, rediscover that child. There's a theologian who I admire very much called David Bentley Hart, and he has a great line about wisdom and experience. And he said that wisdom is the rediscovery of innocence on the far side of experience.
Right.
And for me, that really builds the bridge between those concepts in a way that I don't know, that nourishes my thinking.
Right, so that's so basically what you're saying is that you're trying to regain the innocence, but that's so true. I'm just repeating what theologian said, but it's true. You're gaining innocence, but on the further side,
and that's
which is actually,
I think, of as wisdom in some sense.
That is exactly what it is.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
With all these kind of products that you do and all the kind of things that you delve into, where does it, where you, because you must a lot of the time hit like a dead end or hit positions where you go, okay, that hasn't worked. When it just doesn't stop, there's never end to it. And so you never, as yet, you end up with more questions than answers.
Does that ever make you think, maybe I should stop my work now?
Yes.
Just because I'm becoming less innocent. Yeah. I'm covering.
And also, I'm ending up with more questions than answers. So actually, I remember I did this, I did a police show once where I had to become a special in police force and understand what it was like to be a volunteer. 25,000 people in the UK do it every single year. It's an incredible thing. And what I realized about the police force is there's a constant game. The criminals are always on the run and the police officers are always trying to catch them. Doesn't matter how far they go, the war on drugs, whatever it is, it never ends. But with your research, you almost go throughout life on the constant search, which is fulfilling, but also fulfills you sometimes with an annoyance, maybe?
Well, there's frustration. You know.
Frustration, yeah.
But ultimately, I try to be suspicious of dogmatic certainty, and if I find myself becoming too certain about something, then I think, okay, this may be a moment to sit up and to look at that certainty and ask if it's really telling the truth. And so, really, the point of, I mean, why am I a biologist? Why I inquire into the living world is not necessarily to come up with a set of unassailable facts. In a frame that we can't break open and change later or revise, but rather to find ways to bring us into closer contact with the world around us and to the organisms that we share our lives with. And fungi are a really good example of that because they live most of their lives hidden from our view. It's so easy to forget about these organisms because we can't readily see them. So part of the interest in fungi that we're seeing now, this wave of interest in them, is because we have more access to the fungal world, because we have technologies that grant us access to the fungal world, which bring us into new contact and relation with these organisms surrounding us and can change the way that we then think of ourselves. So microbiomes are a good example. You know, we have microbes all over us, in us, on us, that shape.
Is it we're more bacteria than actual, like, bodily flesh almost?
Yeah, exactly.
What percentage are we?
Well, the actual numbers are uncertain, but it's clear that we carry around more microbes than our own cells. But of course, that raises the question of what is our own.
Yeah, right. Yeah, God. Yeah, what is our own then?
Exactly.
But because surely our microbes, but our own makeup ourselves. That's our DNA, right?
Yeah, but those cells wouldn't be able to do what they do and form this body that we think of as you, this totality that we think of as you, unless they were partnered with these bacteria and fungi doing all these important things for us.
It always makes me think of Star Wars and what's it called on there, mitochondria or something. No, is it mitochondria? I can't remember what it's called in Star Wars. But it's basically this living energy force that's kind of lives throughout everything, basically.
Okay, so why, and the reason why we're getting more access to fungi and things like that is because you said technology and stuff like that. But why have we had that separation for so long? Is that because, you know, we seem to distance ourselves now from holistic health and, you know, natural medicine and natural things. And we're going to the corporates, you know, to feed us with, I don't know, medication or penicillin, I don't know, whatever it may be, you know. And we have this incredible separate. Is that just for financial gain?
Well, this is a very big question.
I know, sorry. I keep asking these huge questions.
We have to go back a little bit further.
Okay, you go back. Yeah, go.
So you might trace this back to a time where the world was divided, at least by the practitioners of what we would now think of as modern science, say Galileo, dividing the world into what he called primary quantities, the things that were measurable, like mass, length, and so forth, and secondary qualities, which were things like color or taste, i.e. our perceptions, the things we feel, feelings and perceptions, the things which are that we add supposedly to the primary quantities out there. And the idea was that the sciences could study, they weren't called the sciences then, but nonetheless what we would now think of as the sciences, could study what was measurable. So we'll bracket off mind, feeling, all those other things, mysterious, unmeasurable things, because the sciences can't do that, because the sciences proceed by measurement.
Right.
And we'll deal with all these measurable things. And that's all perfectly reasonable, provided we remember that there's this whole other part that we bracketed off, and that we've admitted that we can't really handle with these tools over here. But quite fast, the sciences swelled into an entire version, entire metaphysics and narrative of reality, a version of the history of the nature of reality. And this mind-feeling section sort of kept hovering around on the fringes. And so we have this bifurcation that we could then trace into the division between the arts and the sciences, or the humanities and the sciences. And all of these divisions that we see today. But it also divided us from it divided us with our feelings and our perceptions from the world that we were trying to measure. And so it sets up all sorts of confusing boundaries that we stumble over, mistaking them for natural features of our minds. And I think we really suffer from this in all sorts of ways. And it ekes its way into all the structures and systems that we inhabit. And it's actually responsible for a lot of damage and harm. And part of coming to a state of new becoming as a species now at this time of unprecedented challenges to find ways to bring those divisions into unity again.
But how do we do that?
Well, that's
another big question. I'm just giving me all the answers. Give me the answers now.
You write best-selling books.
Fine. How do we try and challenge that, and in some ways try and encourage that?
Well, I can't pretend to know the answer to that question, but I think ways of finding ourselves, finding new relationships with the organisms that we live in and around. And that's why the fungal and microbial worlds for me are so fascinating, because I really do think they help us to embark on a bridging of these distances somewhat, because we realize that we are ecologies, living within ecologies, living within ecologies.
Oh, God, that inception.
Small bacteria living inside them. Fungi have bacteria living inside them. Bacteria have viruses living inside them. It goes all the way down. And so, once we see ourselves like, certainly when I see myself like that and try to feel myself like that, then my sense of self softens and sort of shades off into otherness gradually, and all sorts of other things start to happen. And so that's just one way that I've found helpful to push on this distinction. I think there are many others.
But that also makes me, that troubles me. Okay.
It should do.
Okay, it really troubles me. It really troubles me because of this, right? Because, okay, let's take the idea that we're living in a simulation. Right, in that sort of sense, and I heard that Elon Musk, of all people, explained it in quite a good way. He says, when you see an ant farm, going, you know, in a tank, the ants don't know that they're living in this farm that we've created for them. They're just going about their business and their everyday thing because they're living in a
ecosystem, within an ecosystem, within an ecosystem. So actually what we're talking about with a simulation is perhaps we're just living in an ecosystem, within an ecosystem, within an ecosystem, within an ecosystem. So do we even exist? Well, we do exist, but in what ways do we exist and how we know we exist?
You're having an existential crisis on the podcast. So get him the smelling salts.
He's a freak out right now.
Well, it's a really good question. I mean, one way to think about it that I find helpful is to think of ourselves as bundles of relationships, which is, you know, we are collectives. Mm. And we are singular, a different scale. So if you think about individuality, not as some natural fact, but a category that depends on your point of view. And if you were to think about your digestive system, then you see, oh, well, clearly Jamie is a multitude here. You know, if I'm looking at you now, then I see you as a singular being. If we zoom out and we see all of us together in this city, we might think of it more as a kind of a hive or a swarm of humans and a different kind of entity, individual entity. Mm. So yeah, I think it depends on scale, but relationship, basically bundles of relationships.
But just can you break that down into a simpler form when you mean relationships? Because what we're sort of suggesting here is that we're a hive, as you said, we're a hive within a hive within a hive within a hive. But we know because relationships between what, each other?
Each other and also other members of the living world. So whether it be the microbes that live in and on us or the plants that we eat or the fungi that allow the plants that we eat to live. And feed them, or the bacteria that allow the fungi that feed the plants to, you know, that kind of cascade of relationality. Really, the living world is relation. All organisms are relationship and can only exist in relationship. And so, and that relationship is not just with, of course, other living organisms, but also with physical entities. So when we breathe, we're in constant dynamic exchange with the gases, the gaseous fluids around us, and that is a whole other kind of relationship with an elemental force.
Okay, as a race, we believe we're top of the food chain.
Well, some of us do.
Well, I suppose the naive versions of us, I do. I think we are, but we're not potentially.
Well, I think it's a kind of species narcissism that we are specialized into in a whole kind of what we might think of as modern scientific societies. There are many traditional knowledge systems around the world in which it's very well established that humans are not on the top of some heap in some big old vertical hierarchy. Mm. But in certainly the way I was brought up in this country and being educated in the way that I was, it was implied that humans were like that. And I think there's all sorts of problems. And that thing about intelligence that you ask, you know, there's a big idea we inherit from hundreds of years from Greeks, really, about the ancient Greeks, about humans being at the top of an intelligence ranking, followed by animals that look like us, followed by other animals, and then plants, and then minerals, and in a big old lead table. And and it's explicit about human intellectual supremacy.
I guess it's kind of quite like a primal way of looking at things, isn't it? I think now, more so if we can look at things as like we're all part of the same ecosystem, like a symbiosis almost, then that will hopefully solve some of our...
Yeah, but as a species, are we the only species that are trying to destroy each other and the world? Why do we do that when everything else doesn't? Everything else wants to breathe and grow and...
The animal kingdom does kind of destroy each other a bit.
Well, it's sort of, but not in the same... You wouldn't find other, maybe am I being dumb here? No, but you wouldn't find.
There's the survival of the fittest, which I think is something that's been kind of deeper instilled in us in Western society. I can't remember where I read it recently. It might have been in your book, but survival of the friendliest. Is that?
I don't think it was in the book.
That's not in your book.
What do you mean by survival of the friendliest?
Well, so they were looking back at sort of ancient humans, and I think there was a period of history where there were 11 or 9 different types of humans. You had the Neanderthals, and I can't list any of them.
You're about to give it a go.
I was going to try, and then went, I literally know one. So, and the study kind of concurred that the ones that did the best actually kind of helped each other, and they, you know, rather than tried to kill each other.
Well, this is exactly right.
So rather than the survival of the fittest, it was the survival of the friendliest. They're trying to help each other out.
Well, this is exactly it, right? So the point is that what in survival, right, you're meant to stick together. That's what you're meant to do. But typically, human sort of nature is to not do that. So if you look at books like Animal Farm and things like that, when they, you know, become humans in a sense, they all go against each other. You know, George Orwell's book. But we seem to do that, but in every other
species, they seem to work together. We don't, as humans.
Well, I think we do quite a lot of working together.
Do we?
I mean, we are sitting in a building that was made by teams, designed by an architectural firm and an engineering firm that were working in teams with a wonderful production team around us, with you two working as a team, with me consenting to
maybe I'm being
with your team.
Yeah, I think that's right. Maybe I'm being just really dark about things. I don't know.
I do see your point. I mean, there are all sorts of ways that we feed poisonous dysfunction in the way that we organize and are awful to each other. And that's very true and has been true. I mean, who knows how long it's been true, but you see, basically, in the living world, I think there are ways to think about collaboration which can include, say, conflict and competition, and also cooperation. And if you think about collaboration, there's always some dynamic dance between the two.
Mm.
And I think we all know this quite intuitively. Like, if you think about, a touring band, they can be on tour together, they can hate each other's guts or be having all sorts of fights in the tour bus, but they can get on stage and give a captivating performance. So that collaboration that they have can be... within that collaboration can be all sorts of currents and countercurrents of conflict and cooperation. So that I find helpful as a way to think about the living world in general. We don't have to think of it as all cooperative, essentially cooperative, or essentially competitive. It can and in fact is both in confusing dynamic ways.
That's a great point.
I guess then that's when you start to look at the mycelial network a little bit, and obviously they kind of have a oneness almost. I wonder if we can, as humans, learn from the way that they kind of all cooperate together.
Well, there's also a lot of conflict with, I mean, there are fungi that make a living by ferociously devouring other fungi. And there are fungi that I talk about in the book that ferociously devour insects.
This is fascinating. So this is the bit I've just got to where it's talking about a particular fungi that infects a cicada and only decomposes like a tiny bit of its like rear end so that it can still fly. And it's kind of infected its brain, and it releases amphetamines or something like that to keep this keep the insect. I mean, I'll let you sort of
you
carry
explain
on.
This one.
It's fascinating.
Well, really,
there are different groups of fungi which have come up with these astonishing ways to manipulate the behavior of insect bodies. But they've many of them have evolved this in separate fungal families. So it's a conclusion that many fungi have reached independently, suggesting that it's some kind of a good idea in evolutionary terms. But the idea is that fungi don't have a twitchy muscular body or an ability to walk or bite or fly. So they borrow or commandeer, rather, there doesn't seem to be much consent about it, insect bodies, which they then puppet to their advantage.
Oh my God, that word puppet.
Jamie is now going to have a big fear of mushrooms.
That's the worst thing I've ever heard, puppet. But continue.
Well, yeah, I mean, overwrite their instincts and govern their behaviors in ways that suits the fungus and clearly doesn't suit the insect. So for example, the cicada, the fungus grows into the cicada and produces chemicals which change the behavior of the cicada and cause its back third to disintegrate and to drop off. But the cicada can still fly because the fungus is expertly deconstructing its body. So its surface central nervous system remains intact enough for it to fly, and indeed for its attempt to copulate becomes hypersexual, despite the fact its genitals have long since crumbled away. And so then it goes around spreading the fungal spores this particular type of flight, which is really the fungus in the cockpit driving the insect.
No,
I think that you might.
That is
I think
wild.
You might have been infected in the past. The way you used to fly around with your genitals hanging off.
That is wild.
But there are lots of examples of that. As colourful and confusing, and so do we want to learn from those fungi about how to organize our lives? I mean, that's the thing. So there's so many ways to be a fungus, and fungi are definitely not all having a nice, sweet...
They're not having a great time.
I mean, the fungi, in that case, I mean, they're getting their way. But what I mean by this is that it's easy to think about these organisms as all just happily getting along together, but there's fierceness there too.
There was the theory, and I can't remember if it was your own or if you were talking about someone else's, but taking it further that when humans digest psilocybin, are we essentially becoming a vessel for the mushroom because it changes the way that we perceive the world, and we are actually going to potentially reduce the harm on the planet? And so I found that absolutely fascinating.
So we're ingesting the fungi that could potentially taking over our system and potentially pushing us towards what they want.
Yeah, essentially.
Well, yeah, I mean, so that was a suggestion that Terence McKenna made, another one of his wonderful suggestions.
Terence, what is he doing?
He's taking a lot of mushrooms.
Jesus.
And talking about them very eloquently.
Is he really?
He's got the most amazing voice. His voice is like really, it's on point.
I mean, if the gab was ever gifted to someone.
Yes, that's it. Yeah.
But it's a suggestion, and so it, you know, there's the fungus is not living inside our bodies and puppeting our behavior as the fungi that do that with insects are. You know, these fungi we're eating, you can have the same experience from being injected with chemical psilocybin. Mm. You're not host to a physical living fungus. But there are ways then that our behavior do change. So these magic mushrooms, which are now grown all over the world and entering a new story of domestication with humans. Mm. And this has only been happening over the last few decades. And so just in a handful of decades, a handful of tropical species are now being grown in windowsills, bedrooms, warehouses, cupboards all over the world, in hospitable parts of the world where they wouldn't otherwise be able to make a life because of the way that humans are drawn to them and drawn to the experiences that they can provide. So you can think about this level of this new type of domesticated relationship that we're falling into, like with many plants and animals in our long history, whether or not you want to think about our psychedelic experiences as somehow fulfilling the fungus's plan, we certainly are entering into new relationships with the fungi and propagating them all over the world. And they have certainly won in some sense because of their abilities to alter our minds in this way. Yeah, it's a kind of new story of domestication is how I think about it.
I wonder if their objective is to make people think they're a teapot, because when you took mushrooms, didn't you?
No, I did not think I was a teapot.
You convinced you're a teapot for a week.
I can explain. We're going to stop there for part one. I have a story of when I took mushrooms by accident for the first time that I'm going to share with you in part two. And it was an extremely bizarre experience. You ready for that?
Of course.
Okay, we'll see everyone in part two coming back for that.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.